Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with the remarkable, the versatile, the fiercely creative Diana Colson. You will hear her say that she managed to keep butter on the bread by being the song and dance lady, aka the music teacher. And this work not only compelled her and kept butter on the bread, but it gave her an opportunity to indulge her passions, music and musical theater. She created musicals for her students, but that did not limit her. Diana is a filmmaker, a composer and lyricist, an author, a screenwriter. Her creative output is staggering. And in addition, she is a charming, funny, articulate human being. Diana's story is one of a kind. So hang on. Here it comes.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. That is, not trying to be somebody who you think your mom and dad wanted, or who you think your spouse wanted, or who you think other people are, or maybe you're trying to be the perfect daughter, or the perfect spouse, or the perfect student, or the perfect therapy client. As a therapist, I run into that from time to time, somebody who's trying not so much to be themselves, but to be whatever it is they think I think they should be. So The Lynn Show is about saying to a wider audience than simply the people who I treat that there is a you. There is a you, that person that you actually are, your basic, natural, essential self. And that does not depend on what other people want or don't want or think or don't like or any of that. Unfortunately, as my practice seems to bear out, so many of us are living lives which we are trying desperately to design based on something other than what we actually are. In my book is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And of course, it is about why we can't change when we want to and what we can do if we want to change and we're stuck. In the book, I talk about this idea of being someone other than who we actually are as our cover story. Cover story, like a spy has a cover story. You know that the spy is desperate not to let anyone know that there's a real person under there, and the cover story must not be discovered as a cover story, because that person would be in danger. Well, it's the same thing for us. We create cover stories because we believe that our real self would somehow bring a consequence we would not want. The Lynn Show is about saying, yes, this was probably true for you when you were a child, and the cover story you created was designed to protect you in your childhood from anything like criticism or embarrassment up to and including trauma. But it is not the most effective way to live. And if you are listening to me, or have listened to me, and think that maybe you have left some of who you were behind and want to recover it, you might find the book helpful. If you think you might, you can get it at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You can get the book up there, or you can listen to the first chapter. I believe I have the first chapter on audiobook up there. There's a button to email me, ask me any questions or make any comments that you would like. You can even get me to come and talk to your group or organization. And you can listen to the interviews that I've done, including the one I'm about to air with the remarkable Diana Colson. In the run-up, I said all those things about what Diana does. You will get a sense of that when you hear her and hear her story, which is remarkable. So since it's a long interview, I don't want to talk anymore. So now hear Diana Colson. So I'm here with Diana Colson. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I know that you have given your life and maybe made some or all of your living with several different arts.
Yes, I have.
Yes. So if someone asks you, do you want to just mention the arts that you have spent some portion of your life pursuing?
Yes, I've been a filmmaker, I've been a writer, I've been a composer, I've been a teacher, and when I was in teaching, I wrote much of the material for my children in school. I was the song and dance lady for 21 years at Ashton Elementary School, and before that, I was the song and dance lady at Southside Elementary School.
What is a song and dance lady?
Oh, that's a music teacher. In those days, we used to do a lot with dance and movement.
Oh, amazing.
Now PE does more of that. But anyway, and I wrote a lot of original shows for the kids. I was always a frustrated theater person, and so that I, you know, every music teacher, you only get to see your children once or twice or three times a week if the school is small and you're very lucky. So every person has their specialty areas. If you are a flute player, you're going to emphasize the recorder. If you're a percussionist, you're going to bring out the drums.
Right.
If you're a violinist, everybody's going to learn the violin if you can get a hold of enough of them. So that in music, it's kind of, you know, yes, you do have a curriculum that you follow in general textbooks and all those things, but the specialty areas come from your own interest and background, and my own interest and background was really musical theater, if you want to know where. So I did a lot of musical theater
with the kids,
mm-hmm. And I have all the time. I go to Publix store, grocery or something, and you know, some 6'4", 40-year-old guy comes up to me and says, "Mrs. Colson, do you remember me when we did the Yellow Submarine?" Or, you know, anyway, whatever. And or the Great Carrot Robbery, which I did with wrote for a first grade class, or the Rumpelstiltskin Cantata, which I wrote for another first grade class. And I always taught all the children in the school. I would have hundreds of children at Ashton. 1,025 children came through my classroom every 6 days. The entire school came through on a wheel, and they would, you know, during their time slot, they would come to me on one day, and they would go to the art teacher on another day, and they would go to PE 2 days, that varied sometimes, and they would go to, later on, in my career, they would have computers on one day and then library on one day. So it was like a six-day wheel, and every child went to all of these different programs during that time slot that their class was assigned to a time slot. So anyway, you didn't have hours and hours with them, and the most important thing was to instill a sense of enthusiasm and joy and success. So I personally was not looking for the divine singer or the extraordinarily talented person. I was trying to get Joe Kidd, the ordinary one that maybe was a little off key, to feel that he too could participate and have fun with this and do it on some level, because who knows, maybe they would never participate again after elementary school. Maybe they did. And I had one child go on, well, the age of six, to play Annie on Broadway. Boy, did she come with a natural voice at the age of five, just an amazing voice. And you know, different directions would happen. But the important thing to me about the teaching was the fact that in this, I could have taught classroom also, but in this particular dimension of being the song and dance lady, I could use my own creative side. And I got into filmmaking.
Well, hold on. Because I want to back you up. But first I want to say that I think it's extraordinary that you had that perspective, the perspective of attempting to help these children feel that they could be somebody, that they could do what they wanted to do, that something about them was important, significant, desirable.
Yes.
And I interview only people who make their living or their life within art, and quite often I hear the difference that teachers have made.
Huge.
And many times it is the teacher, a teacher, who has noticed something about them, has encouraged them in some way, and has really changed their lives. So congratulations to you. There aren't enough of you, of course. But the question that I ask is, can you remember the very first moment in your life when you were drawn to music or dancing or singing or any of that, that you either, you spontaneously danced and sang and people said, oh, look, isn't she cute, or?
I didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. My grandfather started teaching me to play piano at the age of two. He had taught both of his daughters. My mother and my aunt were, one was a violinist and one was a cellist, and they played with symphony orchestras and things, and my grandfather always wanted to be a pianist. So I remember two or three, you know, with my legs dangling on the piano key. It wasn't my idea. Mm-hmm. It was his, you know. Mm-hmm. And my sister also, and by the age of six or seven, we were a two-piano team. My sister was a year and a half older than I, and we played all over Los Angeles at women's clubs and on KFI radio and things. With these two nested Steinways, they pushed the Steinways together so they fit like yin and yang, and we would we had an entire literature of two-piano music that we played, and we studied with very fine professors, and my mom could have been Shirley Temple's mother, if you want to know the truth of the matter. I mean, she was, we were pushed, my sister was never comfortable with it. I could live with it pretty well. But as I say, I never know a time. It wasn't necessarily my idea, and I never saw myself as teaching music because it wasn't my thing of choice. It was I wanted to be a ballet dancer. I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be a writer. I am a writer now. I had all these other things that I wanted to do, but my father was ill. He died when I was 16. I kept getting scholarships in college as a music major and as a pianist. I was very good. Not so interested, but very good.
Fascinating.
And so it became a meal ticket for me. So I wanted to be a psychologist. I went for my master's degree at Berkeley, and I thought, I am going to be a school psychologist. I wasn't really following the music track at all then. And when I came to Florida, and our children were...
Whoa, back up. So I find this so interesting and sorrowful. Did you talk about your desire to dance, to write, And did they simply not acknowledge it, or?
No, it wasn't that. There wasn't money in the family.
Oh, yeah.
And then my father was had his first heart attack when I was 10 or 11. He was to die when I was 16. He went through a whole series. So we had medical crises, no money, and Margie, my mom. We always called her Margie. Isn't that interesting? You know, this is what she could pull off.
Right, right.
She would have gone for any of the other things also if, you know.
If there had been space and money and time and all that
and
stuff,
everything
right.
else. But
so
I think
she's doing the best she can, and you're showing this. You're demonstrating this. So did your sister also go on, or did she get out of it the minute she could?
No, she dropped it the second she was 18. She got married, and she dropped it and never touched it again. It was no, you know, she was wonderful. She was very more technically skilled than I. But I found joy in it also, along with it not being my idea. You know, I get it playing this Chopin etude, because I was acting, you know, the great arms going this way and the hair flying and all that, you know.
So you're a performer, really, even in your playing the piano.
Right. I never learned to read well because my mother always felt my destiny was to be a concert pianist, a soloist, and she said, you either read music and then you're an accompanist, or you play music and you're a soloist and you play in front of the symphony. And I mean, I had a couple of fascinating gigs when I was 10, 11, and 12 playing with small orchestras and things like that. I can't even remember now what it was I played, but you know, it was something I was pretty good. But
so you could learn them, you didn't necessarily.
I memorized everything. So even when I got to teaching music in elementary school, I played mainly by ear, looking over the top of the piano, plunkety-plunking away with my fingers and telling Miss Pink Socks to sit down over there. Mr. Blue Shirt, get parked. You know, at the same time I'm doing so, it's time for the tambourine. You know? So it was like touch typing to me. I had it so in my
body.
In my body, and in my heart, and everything like that.
You meet Frank when you're quite young.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so did you, well, apparently you didn't stop teaching. Apparently you went right on teaching, right?
I mean, I went right from school to getting married to, we traveled a great deal the first year we were married.
Right.
We went off on grand adventures, and then we got pregnant, and then we were home, you know, for a while. And I pretty quickly went into teaching because you find if you are married to an artist, sculptor, somebody better get that anchor job that has the health insurance and the other things. And so I did. As a teacher, I always took my coursework and everything during the school year because I did not want to interrupt my summer, because the summer was the time that I became a truly 24/7 creative person. And I could work on making films, I could work on writing things.
Yeah, I want to hear this.
Yeah.
So how did the, what was first? I mean, was it making a film first, or was it?
I always had a passion for making films. This is a very, you as a psychologist would be very interested in this. When I was a little girl, again, we're talking, we lived in Tucson, Arizona, and this was during the Depression, and my father would take a car and drive up to the mines in the mountains, and he would throw a white sheet on the wall of the mountain, and he had a projector and a generator, and project the movie onto the white sheet, and all the miners would sit around and watch it, and I would be sitting in the back of the car looking through the back window. It was an extraordinary experience for me. Now, today's children that watch television, it doesn't seem extraordinary at all, but you have to realize that I grew up, movies were very central to my world, and they were very unusual, and there were fantasies, and my uncle was the head of Midwestern Warner Brothers, my father's brother, and he had a string of 600 movie theaters and what have you. Anyway, we didn't see a lot of him, but he was also a factor. I always was given passes to every movie theater anywhere near where, when we moved to Los Angeles, I had passes to the theater. It was only 10 cents to go to the theater, but I still had a pass. It didn't even cost 10 cents, you know. And so we did this all the time, and it was as I say, not unusual to a child in today's world at
right.
all. Very unusual in the years
okay,
that I
so,
was growing up.
Okay, so clearly this stays with you, this idea of the importance of film.
Yes.
So how do you begin to make a film?
Well, we were... Margie, my mom, gave me the feeling that I could do anything I set my mind to.
Good for her.
Yeah, she did that, and I believed her. Now, mm-hmm. I really jumped off some funny cliffs, and some of them didn't work out so well. But Frank and I were going to Australia. Frank had been offered a studio in Australia, and I took a leave of absence from school. And this was the year it was 1969, I think it was. And just before we were to leave, we were leaving in June when school was out. Just before we were to leave, I had this dream. Things come to me in dreams. And I had this dream, and I decided I was going to make films while we were gone. So I did a little bit of research. I'd never held a movie camera, didn't know anything about it. And I found out that the cheapest professional level movie camera was a Canon Scupic. And at that time was $1,600. It was, and it was you could do professional films with them. Again, in today's world, this is not amazing. It was amazing in those days. And I said, well, I'm going to go buy this. I picked out the camera. I talked to people that were later to become my film partners, Mike and Tony Swain, who were professional film people, and asked them about cameras and stuff. And I went off not having any idea. And Mike Swain said, use a tripod. Whatever you do, you'll be waving all over the place. So I didn't use a tripod, though. I got a monopod, because a tripod was very heavy to put into a suitcase. A monopod, which is a single stick that goes under the camera, at least you don't wave around quite as much as
yes,
you would
right.
have. You know, you got sort of a base. You slant a little bit. But anyway, so we went to... We were going to spend the summer in, we went first to Kyoto, Japan, and then we went to Hong Kong, and we were there in June, July, and August, and then we went to the Philippines, and then we went to Australia. But anyway, I got this, I made my first film in Kyoto. Oh, the reason I knew I thought I could do a marketable film is because in those days, remember, classrooms had 16-millimeter projectors, mm-hmm. and the kiddies would come in, and they'd had 10-minute movies and 15-minute movies, and I thought, well, we're going to go all these wonderful places. I will make a film for young children to see that where it was about, Kyoto, Japan, or about Hong Kong, my first two, and they would be 10, 15 minutes long, and I would make little stories, and I used both of my sons as actors. I thought that an American child in an American classroom would like to see a kid that looked like them. You know, and I made little adventure stories, and they did incredible things like get on streetcars all by themselves and go off into Never Never Land.
How old were they?
Sean was 9 and 10 when I, no, he was 10 and 11, and Kevin was 11 and 12 during these 2 years that we did these films and everything. And they would, sometimes it was, oh, Mom, I don't want to do this. Well, anyway, get out there and act, But it was kind of did to them what my mother did to me.
I was just thinking the same thing, right?
Anyway, it was such an unusual adventure, and I was able to market my first two films to Coronet Instructional Films, I had to edit them after we got to Australia. I hadn't the first idea how to edit a film. I shot all these footage, and I had this little story, and it's like one of the best openings I had was in Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong was, I'm sure it still is, it's very different now, but it was so, all the water and the ferry boats, and I found a two-seater yellow helicopter that you could rent at the airport, and the airport's right in the middle of Hong Kong. The planes come right in with, the high-rises right behind them and the mountain and Victoria's Peak and everything, and I found this little tiny two-piece person thing, and I hired it. It was took you up for little tours, and I put Kevin, my oldest son, I had him run towards the helicopter, climb in, and, you know, wave off, and away the helicopter went off, and then the helicopter came down, and he jumped out and waved and, you know, got out. And so that my opening was when he came down, landing at in Hong Kong Harbor at the airport. And then my ending was he went flying off into the distance, you know, a little fantasy land there. And he had just done the role of the Artful Dodger at the Players Theater for almost, they were on for over three weeks. It was 23 nights that they played the Players Theater.
So he was already...
He was already a theater person.
Right.
Oh, he was so good. A wonderful singing voice, but I couldn't use the singing voice in the stories. Anyway, he was really kicky. It was really fun and strutting around. And, you know, we had him, you know, feel the fish and ride in the rickshaws and go in the boats in Aberdeen and everything else. And in Kevin, with Sean, I did similar. Sean has he was younger, and he had a lower key personality, and we went through these Japanese stone temples and everything like that, and he did more, it's funny, the tone of the film, each film kind of represents the child personality at the time, and he went on the streetcars down this, and he went to Nara Park, where he was petting the beautiful deer that they have in the park in Nara that are quite tame and come right up to you. So both of the pictures were very interesting portraits, the films, were very interesting portraits both of the place where we were, the personality of the child, and everything else. Anyway, so I got to Australia, and I found a racetrack course who took the race movies, you know, the horses running, and I paid them, it didn't cost me too much, to help me edit this thing. So I sat down over their shoulder, and they helped me snip and cut and snip and cut and snip and cut. And we got it together, and in those days you had to edit your film with white gloves on, and you had to paste, because any fingerprints on the film would ruin it. So I sent them off to Coronet Films, and they took them. And so I was launched, and I did another film in Sydney, Australia. Then I went on to shoot one in Bali, in Thailand. Coming back, we went overland from Nepal to London on a 90-day trip, taking our kids with us. And on the way from Australia to Nepal, Kathmandu, we stopped in Bali and we stopped in Thailand, and I made a film in both of those places.
Wow.
And and that was our first trip to Bali, and Bali was to return as the subject of my novel, which I published a year ago. We returned two more times to Bali, and, you know, we were there the first time in the 70s, then we were there again in the 80s, and then time in the 90s.
I'm just so interested in the fact that you waited a very long time to do this thing with film.
Yes.
In your life.
Yes.
But you apparently picked the perfect place and time for you to begin this part of your career, because it was perfect. You knew what you could do with those films when you made them.
Right.
Right. You knew the format that would work. You knew, right? And you apparently, you apparently knew you could do them, right?
I just felt I could.
Exactly. Okay, so how many films did you do altogether?
I ended up making 8 by myself. And then I started partnering with Mike and Tony Swain of Swain Film and Video. The company's now closed, but they brought a level of skill that I had a lot of freshness in the movies I made myself. I have to tell you, I had freshness.
Yes.
But technically, you know, there were a lot of major flaws here and there, which, you know, a kind person would overlook, but a meticulous person would go, oh my goodness, you cut that pan too short, and the lighting is terrible, or this is wiggling or something, you know. And so when I started working with Mike and Tony, the professional level of the film went way up. The stories were always my idea. We did one, some that are still under distribution. One was on the Panama Canal, the longest shortcut. It was a definitive film, a documentary film. It's kind of like a Ken Burns thing.
Mm-hmm.
28 minutes long, and built mainly on black and white stills that I collected when Frank and I were in Panama. This was in the 80s. And I went to this, I started to make a movie down there with my own camera, and then I went, oh, the story is in the ancient story. The story is during the French building of the canal and the American and Teddy Roosevelt and all this stuff. And I went to the library and I found these incredible still pictures, which I could buy for $1.50 a print. And I came back with, they're off the glass negatives. I mean, they're wonderful black and white photographs. And I brought back about 300 of them. And then worked up a script similar to The Path Between the Seas. It's funny, all minds were all happening at the same mm-hmm. time about what was happening with the Panama Canal as it went back to the Panama as the American, America was running it. I shouldn't say occupation, that isn't the right word. But, you know, as the right, Americans right. left the canal to the Panamanians.
Right.
And so there was a lot of books and things coming out. And it was a very, I would have made a fortune if I could have made it about a year earlier. Thing is, it was finished after the canal had been handed back. And so we did well with it, and we got lots of awards on it, but it didn't do as well as it would have been had it been a year earlier. Anyway, but see, Mike Swain did all this. I brought the stills, we wrote the script, and Mike Swain worked with photographing the still photographs, and they were so intense, these glass negative ones, that he would say, Diana, come look, and he would have the zoom lens there, and he'd be zooming in on a window that looked dark to the naked eye, and when he brought the close-up camera in, there was a face in there. There was somebody standing in there, and you couldn't even see it just looking at the picture,
mm-hmm.
And so that was a kind of a very, a totally different film than any other I made, very Ken Burns,
mm-hmm.
and that was one that I did with them. Another that I did with them we won lots of awards on this one. This one was a story called The Red Balloon. Oh, no, it's like The Red Balloon. It's called Pinata. I'm sorry. There was a story called Pinata, but it was a breed of film like The Red Balloon. And just before Frank and I were going to Mexico, see, I always use these summers,
uh-huh.
and I used Frank's adventures to build my own project on.
Yeah,
is what
yeah,
happened.
Yeah.
So he was
right.
down building a native or an indigenous kiln for, they were going to produce pottery. So anyway, I said, oh, I'm going to make a film. Of course. And just before we went, this wonderful story came to me in a dream, and I said, oh my goodness, and I ran out and I told it to Mike and Tony Swain. I said, Mike, you've got to come down and stay with us. We happened to have two houses on this gig because there were different people coming in and out of the States to stay there for 2 weeks at a time, and I said, you've got to come down and stay, and we've got to film this. And so he said, great, of course, let's do it. So I got it cast, I got all the actors picked. It stars a wonderful boy that looks about 8, but he's 12. He's a farm boy. We shot it in his own little village, in his own grandparents, his own parents. He's walking behind his own oxen. He's going down into the city of Oaxaca, and it's about this magic pinata that he falls in love with this pinata, and he saves. It's a Horatio Alger story. He works and works and works to get the money to pay for the pinata, and he finally, when he goes to get it, it has just been sold.
Oh, no.
And it is broken and on the trash pile after the rich children smash it to smithereens. And he takes the broken pieces and he glues them back together. And he has no money left except enough to buy just a tiny handful of little chocolate eggs, maybe 12 little eggs. He drops them one at a time inside this huge pinata, star-shaped pinata, classic star-shaped, golden. And he's glued it back, the pieces, and he drops the pieces in, and then he hangs it up in the tree that's outside his village, and it's one of those marvelous trees on the top of a mountain, and about 35 little village children are there in a huge circle, and with the stick taking their turns to get to hit it, and this, you know, the tension builds and everything like this, and wow! Finally, he gets the stick himself, after all of his friends have not made it, and he hits it, and it breaks, and out of this one pinata come millions and millions and millions of candies and papers and things. Just a rain of you know, these wonderful objects falling out of his one pinata. And, of course, you know he didn't put those in there.
No, it's magic.
And so it's a magic ending. So it was just a beautiful little story. It won all sorts of awards at film festivals. And again, it was on television. It was ran on Calliope, which was the closed-circuit television that ran into children's things. And that was probably the piece of work that was the most creative and the most polished of anything that I did. And it was, but we also did one on Casey Key called Ring Stealer, about a dog. She was shot in the north end of Ring Stealer. These wonderful friends of ours, Kate and Bill Corp, had a beautiful house down there, and they had a dog that I had fallen in love with, a black standard poodle mostly, a few other things thrown in there. And he loved to go down on the beach and dig up the snow crabs, the little white ones. You don't see them much on the beach anymore, but you used to see them on those deserted beaches. And I built an entire story around him and anyway, around this amazing dog. And it's called Ring Stealer. And again, it's a fantasy ending. And it was just so much fun to do and just so exciting. And that also did very well in film competitions and what have you. But then after making 16 of them, I realized, 16 altogether.
Eight with the
Swains and eight by myself. I realized most of these were costing me a great deal of money, and I was the only one I was supporting them by being a teacher was what the truth of the matter is, except for the Pinata made a great deal of money, and so did, it won an award in Mexico. It won a $12,500 award for being the best, showing Mexico in the best light.
Oh.
And it was given by the Mexican government, or the Mexican Tourist Bureau. And it did show Mexico in a beautiful light.
Yes.
It's a lovely little story. It's old now. You know, you have to look at it like the Red Balloon in Paris. Paris doesn't look the same. Well, neither does Oaxaca anymore. It was a time. It was an era. But it was just such a joy to me. So then, where are we now?
Well, what I'm curious about is where did the composing come in?
First of all, I wrote all the time for the children in the classroom. Remember, we're all through all this, I am teaching school from September to June.
Right.
Okay, and so during the school year, I wrote all kinds of things, and I wrote a wonderful series of songs called African Songalongs that are still being distributed. We went to Africa, and I took a still camera, and I was taking pictures all along, and I was writing inside a little notebook in this one pocket, and I would think of these melodies and think of these songs and write them down and take the pictures. And I'll sing one for you. I want to do that. Anyway,
yes.
We were going to find the hippos, and so we were traveling in a bus with 16 people were on the tour, and we were down in the Serengeti, and we were to go to the hippo pool that day. So I'm going to get myself a hippo song. I'm waiting for the hippos. In this case, I carried the tripod, and I got the tripod up. I graduated from a monopod, and I got the tripod up, and I'm ready for action. I have the top of the Bedford bus. We all took turns getting the hood of the Bedford bus because that was the best camera angle, you know. And so I'm all ready for action, and we sit there. No hippos come up. The pool is just still. And finally, after about 45 minutes in the beating heat, one little hippo comes nose up to the water, and you can just see his nostrils, and then he sinks back down. So this is my song. I went to the hippo pool where the hippo hippos go to school, but the hippos followed every rule. They stayed at the bottom of the pool, and all that there arose was a little hippo nose. And that's one of the...
That's lovely.
Yeah, there were 19 songs
it's
on that African Songalongs, and they're still handled today by Songs for Teaching. You can buy them online and off of these website and what have you. And anyway, it's perfect material for kindergarten, first, second grade. You know, it's young children.
So, I mean, except for ballet, so far it seems like you've done everything.
Yeah, I mean, and I did do a lot of dancing, but not ballet. But, you know, I did for a long time, dancing was a part of my life, as well as it could be for a rustier person who hadn't really studied it as a kid.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I did manage to get most of the stuff.
So you did start to talk about the book.
Okay, but before we go to the book, I'll get to the operas.
By all means.
I've written all this stuff for kids, and I've written Dean Allen, who was then the head of the Sarasota Opera, the business head of the Sarasota Opera. Victor Dorenzi was there as the musical head, but this was in the late, it was just 1989, I think. Anyway, she comes to me and knocks on my door. She'd heard that I wrote things for children, you know, the ones in school. And she came and she knocks on my door and she appears. Well, I think she called first, but anyway, she appears and she says, I would like you to write an opera for our youth opera, a performance for our youth opera. I went, whoa, that's a little bit different than a classroom. And she said, I would like you to do it. And I said, well, think about it. And I had written a little picture book that had never gotten published called Cornelius Coyote. And I had another friend, I said, they've asked me to do this and I don't know what to do it. And another friend said to me, Diana, use that Cornelius Coyote story. It would be so charming on stage. And I went, oh. And Cornelius Coyote is a coyote who's born into he's a family of meat eaters. He's a vegetarian. He wants to be an actor. The rest of his family are killers. And anyway, and he wants to go, he goes to Hollywood, look at all my stuff coming in, the Hollywood, the filmmaking.
Right,
and
right,
he goes
right.
And he becomes a film star. And he has his radiant voice, and he has the girlfriend that has the diner and stuff. Well, anyway, so it was a really cute story, and I started writing it, and I had a lot of fun writing it, and I had Bill Prine, who was at that time the arranger for the Ringling Barnum Bailey Circus, and I didn't know enough about arranging music. I didn't know that stuff. I knew how to do a piano score, a melody line and all that with chordal structure, but I didn't know how to do the complexities. And I wrote simple songs because that was my level of what I was teaching and doing and everything like that. And so anyway, we had this show that ran for several nights, Cornelius Coyote, and it was a grand success. Of course, it wasn't exactly opera. It was really musical theater, and I knew it. Victor Lorenzi knew it. We all knew it. Anyway, I did the best I could with it, and it was very, very well received. It was about an hour and 10 minutes long. So that's the first one. I did book, music, and lyrics for that. Then a couple of years later, Dean Allen comes to me again, and Tom Suda, who is this brilliant percussionist, very sophisticated musician, was up for doing the next Sarasota Youth Opera, but he was not feeling comfortable with lyrics. We met, and he said, well, let's try it, you know, and I had never written music, words to anybody else's music. Mm-hmm. I did not know if I could do that, because
right.
I always wrote words first, music second.
Ah.
And this was going to be music first, words second. And I went, well, maybe I'll try it. Let's see if it happens. And it was so funny because we'd have appointments. He was going to come over to the house like at 3 and at 2. I still didn't have anything written. He'd give me his music on tape. I'm listening for 3 days. I'm listening. And usually 10 minutes before the door opened, the words would pop in my head that would fit his very angular music.
Really?
And so we did Eye of Ra together. And it was, again, a grand success with the youth opera. And as a matter of fact, he and I are considering putting an entry together. I understand the youth opera is looking for a new piece to write for the commission for the year 2017. And I don't know if we're eligible because we've written for them before. Maybe they're looking for composers they've never had before. But it was a long time ago. Both of us did these in the 90s, you know. So it's been a long time ago. So we may partner again and send another thing in and see if we win. But of course, I think we'll win because I think we're awfully good. And we work awfully hard, too. Mm-hmm. So that's that one. And then I did music and lyrics for The Fabulous Mrs. Palmer, a musical about Bertha Palmer. Joe Morello wrote the book. And we got all kinds of grants. It was performed at Manatee, then called Manatee Community College, now called whatever it's called.
Yeah,
it's not called that anymore.
Something.
State School, I don't know.
Right, right.
Anyway, so that was all about the life of Bertha Palmer, and it was biographical, and bits and pieces of it have been done since then, but never hit the stage that one time. And then came the novel. Now, I started this novel in 1997, when Frank and I went to Bali for the third time. I'd been there every decade. We'd gone there and been there for the last two times we were there for the whole summer. We traveled over with a yoga group, which was a lot of fun. And that's a dance thing coming in. I was really into yoga at the time. And I got, again, this idea, again, and these come to me, if not exactly in a dream, certainly in the middle of the night. It's a great time to mind your mind, you know. And so I got this story that's based on the power of love, the magic of a child, and reincarnation. And it came to me pretty much full-blown, and I started writing it there. I bought a laptop. See, these teaching schools was handy because I have the money to buy a laptop. I wasn't, you know, sleeping under a bridge or something. You know, I was able to do these things. And I started writing it down by the pool. We had a beautiful little place. At the time, it was $15 a night. And it was a little, beautiful little Balinese place in the middle of the rice fields. And every day somebody came and cleaned the room. And I would sit out by overlooking the swimming pool and watching the ducks go by and, you know, working on my laptop. So it was fun. So I got the book pretty well started. And then I faced up to the fact that in this cold, cruel world, what chance did I have really to get a book published? Again, you have to place this in the 90s. Things have changed now, but this was 20 years ago, 25 years ago, something like that. Anyway, I thought, I don't have any real chance to do this. So, we were on our way out to visit a lifelong friend. Whose name's Dawn Aldrich. And Dawn Aldrich was married to Marty Cohen, who was the producer, writer, director of Who's the Boss and Different Strokes, and she wrote with him all the time. She had a brilliant career of her own. They both met on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. They both wrote for, you know, Bob Newhart. So we're on the plane going out there, and I thought, I'm going to tell her my story, because really, it's a film. It's really a film script. I'm going to tell her that story. They are so well connected that if I tell her that story, if she would like to partner with me on a screenplay version of it, you know, will become, it'll all happen.
Right.
And so she had this beautiful place in Carmel, and I went out and I spent time, you know, a month out there, and we worked and worked and worked, and we took the story and tweaked it into a screenplay, and it was a little wonderful fun working with her. It was just great fun. So, anyway, but then I was to find out, as in other fields, you know, once you retire from Hollywood and you've gone away from it, your connections evaporate, and if you aren't 28 years old, Hollywood is not a very welcoming place. And as brilliantly as connected and successful as both Dawn and Marty had been, it didn't make a big bunch of difference. And so there we were with, you know, nothing was getting picked up. I dredged up a little interest in it, but nothing really went through. And so I thought, I'm going back to the book. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I'm going to kill myself trying to chase a publisher. You know, you can spend years trying to find a publisher. I thought, I'm going to publish it myself. So I went with Abbott Press, and it got terribly good reviews on it. And it's had, I just haven't been busy enough to market it the way that I need to. Because
you mean you've been too busy to market it?
I've been too busy to market it, is what I should say, yes. Mm-hmm. I've been too busy to market it. And it's, in today's world, if you do the self-publishing route, you better be prepared to make, you know, push the appearances, get to the book clubs. And I've spoken to many book clubs and had a lot of fun doing it. And I've had terrifically good reception, and I've sold locally very well. I have not been able to break the out-of-town crowd, partly because of my total situation at the moment, you know. And I have to be here. And so there it is. I love the book. It deserves to be out in the world.
Well, actually, how do people get it?
It's sold by Abbott Press, ABBOTT Press. It's a division of Writer's Digest. So I'm just going on Amazon.
Okay,
the title is Triple Destiny, because it's the entwinement of three lives, and that's the triple part, and they were destined to be together.
All right. I ask another question.
Sure.
And both you and Frank are a challenge for me in this, because you are so diverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, having given a life essentially you have given a life to creativity.
Yes.
You have, as I see it, you're somebody who's deeply connected to her unconscious, and her unconscious just keeps giving her
ideas. That's true.
Ideas,
that's
you
true.
Know, I mean, right, exactly. You're completely connected to your internal creativity, and it just keeps providing stuff for you to explore and develop.
It does.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So, generally speaking, when I interview artists, I interview people who have a work, you know, they're an actor, they're a musician. Sometimes it's maybe a little bit of something else, but not anything quite like this. This, I think, is really unusual.
Oh, okay.
Right. So, would you think for a minute what it's been like to be a person who's been sort of at the mercy of her internal prompting? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah.
And would you say something about what that's been like, what that feels like, what you think about that?
You become a bit of a workaholic, but I have the feeling that we're just here for a brief time on this planet, at least this time around, and I want to make the most of it. I want to make the most things happen. And you're absolutely right about the middle of the night. They're not exactly demons. They're little fairies dropping brain cells upon me or something, because I just started another screenplay about 2 weeks ago in the dark of night, and goodness knows if anything will ever happen, but I've got my roughed out story going. It is, I get impatient with things that keep me away from getting to the stuff that I want to work on, and I have a lot of interferences right now, and it's very, I can get very, very frustrated about that. I would just like a good, clean day where I got up at 8 in the morning and went to the, you know, and worked from 8 to 12 and went to the gym from 12 to 1 and came back and worked from 1 to 5, and then I'd be a happy woman and went and partied at night.
Yeah. Pretty clear, for me anyway, that this is what feeds you.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
But I do think the conventional wisdom that one ought to lay back somehow, I don't think that's true.
No.
I think you are a person who's so deeply connected to who she is that you are in sync with yourself, and it doesn't require what other people would think of as laid back. You're in your zone.
Yeah.
You know, and it's glorious. And I really want to say that I think that it's inspirational, really.
Well, thank you.
You know, I think the your ability to continually excavate, you know, what your creativity is giving you, in whatever form it gives you, the minute it makes itself known, you grab it by the balls and you run with it.
Yep.
And my own personal feeling about this is that the creativity is more important than what happens to it, whether it...
You are absolutely right.
You know.
You're absolutely right. Of course, I want something marvelous, and I want the acclaim and the notice. I want success. But I did figure out how to keep butter on my bread by teaching school.
Yes, I did.
So I'm not going glug, glug, glug and sinking into the mire of starvation or something, which could happen. So, you know,
I protected myself. You're a responsible human being.
Yeah.
You're a responsible human being who has also figured out a way to be herself in this world. I think it's really marvelous.
Oh, well, thank you.
Really?
My goodness.
Really?
My goodness. It hasn't been, lots of times it has not been easy.
I'm sure it hasn't. I'm sure it hasn't, because it's a juggling act, isn't it?
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
But you seem eminently capable of keeping those balls in the air. Thank you very much for this.
Oh,
this was great.
Thank you. It's a real treat to talk to you.
So, there you have it. A person who has been able both to honor her responsibilities as a human being, as she says, to continue to put butter on her bread, to make sure that she and her family are well taken care of. At the same time, to do a work which is about helping other human beings, children. She talks at length about
wanting to help every child, not just those who are naturally talented or feel good about themselves, but every child to feel good about him or herself. And she, at the same time, she uses her skills and her passions for musical talent and her passion for musical theater to enhance her life and the lives of her students. And then she manages to honor every single one of her creative impulses. And they are legion. She is interested in, compelled by, drawn to every possible way of using creativity. This is a woman who knows who she is at every turn and has honored everything about herself, and in doing so has just enhanced the world that she inhabits. So it is my hope that having listened to Diana, you are asking yourself, am I using everything that is me? Am I using everything that I came in with? And if the answer is no, I hope that you are at least considering the possibility that it's possible to recover some of what you may have had to leave behind. And as always, of course, I hope you got something from this show that you can use, something that intrigued you, inspired you, tickled you, informed you, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't.